is the Cranium Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Cranium Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Gralian bunker. Once again, my friends, welcome. I'm Micah Hanks. And if you're here, you know where you are. You've locked in to the Gralian Report. Glad as always to be keeping you company Monday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the East Coast here. And of course, listening on demand worldwide around the globe on the internet, available at any time. And of course, through the courteous streaming services of our friends here at the Worldwide Global Radio Alliance, KGRARadio.com. So glad to be here with you. So much happening in the world. We're going to be talking about the end of the world tonight, as well as the search for dark matter, the search for space suits, the search for a lot of different things. And then in hour two, since time travel is so often discussed on this program, Dr. Future himself, Mr. Mike Bennett, will be here with us to talk about some new revelations as they may pertain to an old mystery, one that I've followed for a very long time, one pretty close to home, and whether or not the Rosicrucians may have anything to do with it. That's right, that's going to be during hour two, a new documentary film that may reveal the identity and more details about an all-time mystery here in the United States. But we'll talk more about that a little bit later. Speaking of all-time mysteries, one that I've been pursuing, as listeners of this program well know, for years now, involves the Brown Mountain Lights. And I was down in the Linville Gorge once again. It's that time of the year. My dear old friends, Bill and Bob of Bell Laboratories, they're no longer with Bell Labs, but they met working as engineers at that location, Bob Ashmore and Bill Fox. And they're engineers by trade, photo enthusiasts, mountain climbers and hikers, and also men who pursue mysteries like yours truly. And so Bill and Bob, about once a year, they come down on part of their vacation time, and they head to the Linville Gorge, and they try and take photographs of anything that might be happening over around the area of Brown Mountain, which the locals maintain it's not just Brown Mountain. It's not just the Brown Mountain Lights. And since we've talked about that a lot over the years on this program, I'm not going to get too in-depth into the Brown Mountain Lights right now. If you're a newcomer, and we've been picking up a lot of new listeners lately, so welcome if you are fairly new to the program. But if you aren't familiar with the Brown Mountain Lights, if you do a Google search for that, you'll find a lot of information. You'll also find a few videos and articles that feature me talking about this. And we know that these lights have been reported at least for the better part of the last century. There are some anecdotal reports that claim that Native Americans reported seeing these in even earlier times, prior perhaps to European settlement in the region. Now, there's nothing that confirms that, and frankly, many archivists throughout this part of the United States and elsewhere have looked for information that actually recorded these Native American legends. And while there are some Native American legends about this region that involve unexplainable aerial phenomena, I haven't been able to find any information that directly links any of that kind of thing, spiritual, folkloric, no matter what the interpretation. Those reports just don't come up a whole lot in relation to Brown Mountain. Although there was an article many moons ago that appeared in the Charlotte Observer that made such a claim, and hence I think at very least the idea, the notion that the natives had talked about this for years, when in fact there wasn't really any evidence that suggested that was the case. So in large part it's considered a modern phenomenon, although George Mansfield back in the 1920s with the U.S. Geological Survey had said that there were reports from locals who said that they had seen these lights and that the reports of the illuminations around Brown Mountain at least dated back to around the time of the Civil War, which is what led him to think that it was the fact that the lights began to appear coinciding with the institution of railroads throughout the region, that in likelihood what the Brown Mountain lights probably were just railroad lights seen at a distance. But I'll tell you this, some of the better photographs I've seen, including some by Bill Fox, Bob and Bill, having spent numerous hours over the years, over about two decades, heading up there and taking these photographs. We featured them at the website, GralianReport.com, and I've also featured them in articles at Mysterious Universe. It does seem to me that there is a case to be made for some phenomena that is aerial in nature and akin to ball lightning. And this is a theory that has been proposed by others in the region, including the skeptical astronomer at App State, Dan Caton, a friend of mine, who has wavered back and forth about whether or not there's really any phenomena. The Orion Group, which is, they're defined as a team of amateur scientists, but a lot of them were also scientists and engineers at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. But back in the 70s, the Orion Group conducted their own experiments, and they tried to see if there was something geological or seismic in nature. And they, on the Brown Mountain Ridge, actually detonated small charges of TNT to try and see if there was any kind of a seismic reaction that might occur at night, and they still reported seeing no illuminations, although in one really interesting experiment, they shone something like a 1,000-candle light up over the ridge and asked observers what they saw when the light was directed above the ridge, and they actually described seeing what appeared to be a reddish orb of light hovering over the mountain. And hence, what they had determined was that some of the lights that appeared to be aerial in nature may be refractions through the atmosphere of more prosaic sources of light, perhaps emanating from Morganton or some other city, Lenore, or another location off in the distance. And hence, there's a lot of question about these aerial illuminations, but one really good photograph that Bill Fox managed to get a few years ago, actually a series of photographs in sequence, obviously show the light passing through the air and moving up into the sky. It does not appear to be consistent with an aircraft leaving from an airport which is known to exist off in the distance. I couldn't tell you what this thing was, and I'm still of the mind, I'm open to the idea that there's something like ball lightning that occurs a little more regularly than most places there at Brown Mountain, but there are other locations where this is reported with regularity. Hestalen, Norway, and purportedly around Marfa, Texas. A few other places, too. So, anyway, we were down there last night, and I lugged my great big Celestron telescope down there, which actually wasn't all that hard to carry, especially since there were four of us. Mike Kite, a photographer from Durham, North Carolina, and also a man who has a background in engineering with the U.S. Air Force. Very grounded kind of guy. Very, very skeptical-minded, but, you know, just also equally curious. A lot like me, really, in terms of his disposition. But so I brought my telescope, and Mike had an expensive camera array, and then Bill and Bob were also taking photographs, and people were coming and going, you know, some campers. Cindy Peters and her husband David that operate the Parkview Lodge down the mountain in Linville, Falls. They were also there. And we stayed out all night, you know, just looking, watching, waiting. Nothing showed up. And in most cases where I've been there, in fact, I think all but one, I've never seen anything that I couldn't conclusively tell you was an anomalous aerial illumination. I've seen aircraft. I've seen campfires. I've seen people pointing lasers. I've seen people launching fireworks off of the top of Table Rock. And considering the range fire that occurred there just a couple of years ago, that's probably an extremely bad idea in the summer months. So please, if you visit a national park, don't launch fireworks. But sadly, people with knowledge of what is reported in that area, the aerial illuminations, there are people who do all kinds of things. And as one firefighter in the region had told me, a lot of the time you get up there and there are people playing Brown Mountain lights because they know that the spectators on the other ridge, you know, a few miles away are looking at this thinking, oh, wow, look, we're getting a real fireworks show tonight, when in fact, that very well may be what they're getting, an actual fireworks display that should not be. So, anyway, in my experience, the best evidence that I've seen for actual aerial illuminations that occur at night at Brown Mountain are the Bill Fox photographs. And a team of researchers, a former geologist, Ed Spear, a friend of mine, Dan Caton, and a group of others, invited me to come speak at one of their meetups where this team of individuals who work together working toward the solution that may underlie the Brown Mountain Lights phenomena. We observed Bill Fox's photograph, and you know, there were a lot of different opinions about it, ranging from, oh, this could have been photoshopped, which I assured them. I said, I don't think this was photoshopped, and I know Bill and Bob well enough, and I've known them for years. I don't get the impression ever, nor have I, or would I, that they would be trying to intentionally pull the wool over my eyes or anyone else's. But we ruled out celestial phenomena, aircraft, and also the moon. And in conclusion, that doesn't necessarily mean we're dealing with something paranormal, supernatural, inexplicable. It remains, I suppose, anomalous in that we cannot account for what the source of the illumination was. And based on that determination, or lack thereof, which I think is good skepticism, rather than trying to offer some sort of a opinion, if we can't explain it, leave it be and say, okay, this one could be something we can't explain, and we can leave it at that. That, to me, is at very least the best evidence that I think I've come across that there's something going on down there at Brown Mountain. And one more reason why we address that enduring phenomena on this program, and why, of course, I try to do as much field research in relation to that as I can with my quote-unquote summertime science buddies. Yeah, nothing like late nights on a mountain ridge with lots and lots of cameras to get you interested in strange phenomena. That'll do it for you. And speaking of strange phenomena. I wanted to mention, by the way, before we get into some discussion about dark matter, that Matthew Oakley is not joining us tonight in the studio because he is celebrating his birthday. And I told him, please, by all means, take the night off. Although he hasn't been here in recent weeks, the fella certainly deserves a night off. So if you follow the Graylian Report on social media, specifically the Graylian Reverend on Twitter, you might just send a quick happy birthday greetings to the young man. Hope he's having a great time wherever he may be. I'm sure he's in good company. And on to the hunt for dark matter, which in many instances has been described as a proverbial invisible needle in an infinite haystack. Now researchers are thinking that there may be a new clue as to what exactly the nature of dark matter entails, why we have such a hard time finding it, and whether or not, in fact, it is something that's been under our noses all along. Now, as reported at IFL Science recently, a team of scientists has theorized that dark matter is not the exotic particle everyone had thought it would be, but instead maybe nothing more than a different version of a humble pion, a particle known to science since 1935. Now, pions, for those who don't know, are the particles that bind atomic nuclei together, a sort of lattice in the infrastructure of the universe. Now, dark matter, the team suggests, would be similar but not exactly the same as regular pions. When people talk about dark matter, they assume it is really exotic stuff, like an extra dimension, or maybe something involved in the supersymmetry of the universe that's been proposed by many of the forward-thinking physicists of our day. But Hitoshi Murayama of the University of California at Berkeley and the University of Tokyo, also a co-author of the study published in Physical Review Letters, has said, of course, this idea is very sexy, as he puts it, but at the same time, as far as these extra dimensions and supersymmetry, there's no evidence really for it. So we think it could be something more mundane and maybe more familiar to us. I often wonder, folks, whether or not our determinations about the nature of the universe, the nature of dimensionality, the nature of time itself, whether all of these things are merely the byproducts of suppositions we've made about the universe in which we present what I've often called placeholders, like dark matter, in an attempt to try and reconcile with the seemingly irreconcilable aspects of the universe according to laws and, well, if not laws, theories put forward by the likes of Albert Einstein with relativity and whatnot. So, anyway, Dr. Muramata goes on to say, dark matter is our mother. Without it, no stars, galaxies, or even us would be born. It's thought that just 380,000 years after the Big Bang, it was dark matter that was responsible for breaking the uniformity or smoothness of the known universe. And tiny variations in dark matter therefore upset the balance of the homogeneous cosmos, allowing matter to lump together and form the stars, galaxies, and planets that we see today. But the significance of a theory that involves something more mundane is that it could indicate a discovery of dark matter is imminent via experiments running around the world at present. Right, let me give you an example. Okay, we've got the Large Hadron Collider, the ever-controversial operation over there at CERN. But we've got others as well. The new Super KEKB and the upcoming SHIP project could all potentially make a discovery in the near future that scientists believe could prove if this pion theory, as it relates to dark matter, is correct. Murayama says that the minute we proposed it, people wrote a bunch of papers to test how to prove it, and so there's quite a bit of excitement that maybe this entire time the dark matter mystery was something far more humble and mundane, hidden, tucked away under our proverbial noses. Imagine that. But how often is that actually usually the case? I would argue probably a lot more often than many in the science community are willing to admit. And speaking of things going on in the science community, there's been a lot of buzz lately, but not about Buzz. It was about Neil Armstrong, or more specifically, the suit that he wore during the historic moonwalks. And that particular suit has apparently been rescued, as some are saying, and is set to go on show before the public, thanks in large part to a successful crowdfunding appeal for $500,000 that will be bankrolling the exhibition. Now, the Smithsonian Institution had said earlier this month it hoped to raise the cash to fund the construction of a special climate-controlled display case and a full 3D digitization of Armstrong's NASA outfit. So the Smithsonian launches a Kickstarter to crowdfund an operation to mark the 46th anniversary of the Apollo 11 touchdown on the moon, and it sought about $500,000. And according to the Register in the UK, at the time of publication of an article that appeared earlier, $534,959 have been pledged already from 6,724 generous backers, and there are still 23 days left to raise further funding for this. Interesting. So the Register reports, had the citizens of Earth failed to respond to the campaign, the suit would have been left to collect dust in storage. The Institute decided to launch this appeal as a way of raising private money for exhibits that are not covered by federal funding from the U.S. government's purse. The Neil Armstrong Reboot the Suit campaign, as it had been called, was always going to be a bit of a crowd pleaser, so good on the org for raising awareness that it needs funds for some of its exhibits. And yeah, I guess better that than having to tap more federal dollars to do so. Maybe we could use that surplus funding to get the Smithsonian to release all the information about all the hidden stuff up there in their archives and catacombs, right? No, I'm kidding. Don't worry. Watch somebody quote me on that. In other news, this is another one that was carried over the weekend, and one that was fascinating to me because I'd written about this some time ago. The idea that is there a 2-billion-year-old nuclear reactor in Africa? And if you look into this, there are a lot of articles that suppose that there is evidence of an ancient technology that harnessed nuclear power. And here's what we know. Now, the first nuclear reactor to actually become functional was in 1951. It didn't produce a whole lot of energy. But there is this natural uranium deposit, I suppose, at Okla, which is a location in Gabon. And these are apparently natural conditions within a rock casing that are right for maintaining nuclear reactions that have occurred for around 2 billion years. Now, back in 1972, this was discovered by French scientists who took uranium ore from the mine in Gabon to test its uranium content. Now, typically, uranium ore is made up of three types of isotopes. Uranium, each one with a different number of neutrons. Uranium-238, that's the most abundant. And then we've got uranium-234, which is the rarest. And uranium-235, which nuclear scientists are most interested in because it can sustain these nuclear reactions. One would expect that the uranium ore is composed of, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.72% uranium, 235 that is, since this is the percentage found in other rock samples from Earth's crust, the moon, and even meteorites. But get this. In 1972, the French scientists who were taking these samples found something interesting, that the uranium contained only 0.717 uranium-235. Now, that might not seem like a huge deal, okay? We're off by, you know, a couple of decimal places, right? 0.003, I believe, to be exact. But when it comes to uranium, that's a pretty significant difference. And here's the reason why. Back at the time, there were around 200 kilograms of uranium-235 appeared to be missing. It hadn't been lost or stolen. It was missing the 0.003% because apparently it had undergone nuclear fission and split into other atoms. This conclusion may very well have furrowed some brows, since there are three very specific conditions that a reactor needs to churn out energy continuously. And as even scientists had struggled to create a nuclear reactor, it seemed very unlikely that nature had just happened to, by accident, produce one in this way. Unlikely, but not impossible. And they say that this is exactly what had happened, that these conditions had indeed provided for a natural reactor, which had been in operation for something like 2 billion years. The reactor had a supply of a regulating substance as well, a flow of natural groundwater. So as the atoms started to split, they released neutrons as well as energy. The water would slow down the neutrons, the cooling effect, of course, but the energy would heat up the water. And then after a time, the water would get so hot that it would start to boil off. And eventually, enough of the water would have boiled away until there wasn't enough left in the reactor to slow down the neutrons. So guess what happens? The neutrons start shooting off into the ground without reacting with anything, and then the reaction would stop. But then the natural flow of groundwater would trickle in again until there was enough water to start that whole process over again. And this was believed to have occurred on and on and on for hundreds of thousands of years. Incredible. Now, it's said that the levels of uranium-235 got used up and the level was too low to sustain any more meaningful reactions, but the fact that it had happened for such a long time and in a natural circumstance is indeed pretty fascinating to us. And it's no doubt that it had led to the idea that maybe there were ancient cultures, those who came before us, who had utilized such technologies in ancient times, and perhaps had even destroyed themselves. Maybe this is the great enigma of the ancient past, and why there are so many mysteries about it, that there were people who had actually harnessed nuclear energies at that time, and after destroying themselves, of course, after maybe 2 billion years or so, this is, of course, going to appear to be a natural nuclear reactor when, in fact, it's the remnants of something that someone had built long ago. Is it possible? might be possible. I don't know. Seems highly unlikely, especially when we take into consideration things like evolutionary science and the evidence that very clearly seems to suggest the ancient lineage of humankind. But I have wondered about whether or not there are things about the ancient world that we do or do not know, and at very least, whether or not some sort of a cataclysmic event could in part play into that. And Tech Times had reported recently about something that had come up around the same time as the discovery of the natural reactor at Okla. This was, again, well, maybe a little earlier. We're talking around 1972. It was a study that conducted that the world might end in around 2050. And their reasoning for this in 1972 had been that the Earth would run out of resources and become uninhabitable as a result of everything from overpopulation to scarcity that, of course, probably is going to occur in equal measure to the population increase. And then finally, we take into consideration things like climate change and also the likelihood that, well, Earth could be bombarded by a meteorite or an asteroid or something along those lines. Well, Tech Times reports that scientists from the Global Sustainability Institute of the Anglia Ruskin University have put that date back now. They say we probably won't see the end of all life as we know it in 2050. No, it's going to be 2100 instead. Yeah, they're only setting the date back 50 more years. So we at least have until the end of this century to survive. Scientists claim that the Earth will no longer have clean food, however, by that time, and other crucial resources which will make it impossible for humans to survive beyond around the year 2100. Now, for this new study, which was published in the journal Sustainability, Aled Jones and colleagues updated the computer model that had been used back in 1972, and they hoped to try and predict how finite resources on Earth actually are. And Jones had said that while scientists who conducted the study about four decades ago made a good attempt, their prediction was just too pessimistic. So the researchers acknowledged that the science that predicts the apocalypse is not an accurate one, saying that there's still a lot of questions on exactly when planetary limits will be reached and what the effect will be on Earth when this happens. The researchers said that growth based on material consumption cannot continue indefinitely and is not grounded on the idea that the Earth has limited resources and land availability. When you run the newly calibrated World 3 model forward in time, society will collapse this century based on reasonable guesses of these limits, although there is, of course, great uncertainty around exactly what these limits are. So Jones said the society has to find now solutions to some of the problems noted in 1972, but that is important to learn, or rather that it is important to learn lessons from what has already been achieved and focus on efforts to avoid limits. And he concludes by saying, global resource scarcity is a real thing. I personally believe, Jones, that we should also solve massive inequality as we re-engineer our economy. I don't think any solution that does not address inequality provides economic stability as the availability of information and increasing access to visualizing the identities of the inequality are now just a touch of the button away. And in addition to addressing things like inequality and other economic issues on planet, and the idea that, well, we don't have endless resources, and as more and more people are populating the planet, we don't have endless resources, let alone the land to actually house these people, we do have to think about certain things. Right here in my hometown of Asheville, for instance, there are many people who are against the idea of building new skyscrapers and buildings in our little mountain town. They say, let's preserve the Asheville skyline. We don't need any more tall buildings. I don't know that I agree, and I'll tell you why. And I'm just using this in the little microcosm that is my hometown of Asheville, North Carolina, but you'll see where I'm going with this. If you want to protect, you know, the countryside, if you want to protect the nature, if you want to protect the mountains and the beautiful scenic area known as Asheville, my feeling is you'd be better to build up rather than to build out. Now, that's how I feel. And no, we don't have to talk about, you know, like a, you know, something along the lines of the Burj Khalifa, you know, or something like that. We don't need some mystical gigantic tower that's going to rise, you know, ponderously toward the heavens. You know, we're not talking about, you know, building a stairway to heaven. We're talking about a skyscraper that is going to utilize more vertical space than space on the ground. And hence, when we talk about concerns about things like urban sprawl, to me, logically, it makes more sense to build up rather than to build out, if indeed something that people are concerned about is urban sprawl. And when you have deer and bear and other wildlife that are coming into your backyard and raiding your vegetable plot, well, of course, these furry friends probably feel like their backyard is the one that was being raided. And in fact, in truth, That really is what's happened. And so I always said that, to me, you know, while people may not like, for instance, the Asheville skyline changing and the idea that our city's going to look much different in 10 years with all these buildings being built, yeah, sure, that is an issue. But it is something that I think is an exterior problem to the notion of the city actually widening and growing and taking up more floor space, so to speak. So build up, not out. That's something that I've always felt logically made more sense. And while it may change the appearance of a city, you know, that city isn't going anywhere. It can go up, as they say, the sky's the limit. But if it goes out more and more, the urban sprawl problem is going to continue to be something that's going to have to be addressed. And I know that there are people who will disagree. There's probably somebody who, because of the culture of constant offense that we exist in these days, somebody will hear this and say, oh, just unsubscribed on iTunes, going to leave some negative feedback for you over there. Which is funny because despite the multitude, I can't even get to all of them on this program, but despite the multitude of emails that we get and tweets from people who are so supportive of what we do, it's like the 0.00001% that don't like what we talk about on this show. They're the ones that have to go and leave reviews on iTunes. I love it. I wish there was some way I could reach out and contact some of them. Like, for instance, the guy who left the one-star review because I chose to look at the history, the actual history behind the Confederate flag debate. And furthermore, cite a history, the head of the history department at UNCA here in Asheville in doing so. But then again, I guess he doesn't know anything about history, and neither do I. So that said, if you like this program, and you've got a few minutes, it would be wonderful, although I appreciate all the emails, and I want you to keep sending them, info@graylyreport.com. But if you have a minute, you might, if you like what you hear, head over to iTunes and leave us some review love. That would be much appreciated indeed, and thank you so much for all the support that you show. When we come back after this break, I want to get to some of the listener emails and the feedback, because for 2 weeks now, I have been saying we would do that, and I haven't been able to make the time to do so. So we'll get to that on the other side of this break, as well as more in news. I want to talk about some of the purported conspiracy theories, not to weaponize the term, I'm using it in the very literal sense, as they apply to the idea of holistic doctors being killed and other medical professionals that are going missing. We'll talk about that when we come back here on the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. And as promised, for weeks now, I've been meaning to get to my emails from people. So we're going to go through a few of these in rapid succession. And then I want to go ahead and bring on our guest, because we've got so much to discuss with him. I'm not even going to wait until the second hour. I want to make sure we've got plenty of time for all of this. It's going to be an incredible discussion. And yes, Jesus might even fit in, Hunter. That said, Craig writes, Mike, a quick question. I'm just wondering if you're familiar with an author named Daniel Cohen. It was his books that really got me interested in the world of the paranormal. His books, Encyclopedia of Monsters, The World of UFOs, and The Great Airship Mystery, were of particular influence on me. I still have the latter displayed proudly on my bookshelf. I remember him being the first author whose books I would actively search for on visits to the library. I'm just looking for an educated opinion on his works, and any insight would be helpful. Craig from Fort Collins. Thank you, Craig. Yeah, a lot of us in 4TN circles grew up reading Daniel Cohen's writing. He was a science writer, largely, and he wrote a lot of books about unexplained phenomena. I had the benefit of being able to participate in an interview with him many years ago. I don't know if he's still alive, but Daniel Cohen is indeed one of the more prolific authors from the 1970s, especially for young adult books on the unexplained. And a little-known fact, by the way, like yours truly, he was a person who took a very skeptical attitude toward unexplained phenomena. He wrote a number of books about it. He didn't advocate necessarily anything from the ancient astronaut theory to cryptozoology, but he wrote at length and in depth about all those subjects, and so he's certainly someone that many of us know of. I should try and see if he's still around. It'd be great to talk to him again after all these years. Rebecca writes, "Thanks, Micah, for suggesting the James Randi documentary. I was fascinated and surprised by his story. I hadn't given him much thought until seeing this film. I find him to be a very good man, not to mention a brilliant one. Thanks again for mentioning this on your show." And I agree. You know, James Randi, despite the controversy surrounding that character, you can't watch that documentary. It's called An Honest Liar. You can't watch that and not see the benefit in what he does. I think the problem is that there have been also a lot of skeptics who have followed in his footsteps and taken it to the next level of snarkiness and trying to emulate that. And in doing so, they go about just attacking everyone who makes extraordinary claims, whether or not it is entirely warranted. But I've said plenty about that in previous episodes of the program, so I won't go into that right now. One of our very own Graylian Newsies, Mark Brady, sends the next message. He says, another good set of shows. I've been catching up, and I've got some comments for you. Mark says, one, I agree with you that making guns illegal would not be productive. Now, that may not have been discussed on the public podcast, but we certainly featured that on a Graylian X episode recently. He says, as you noted, it hasn't worked well with marijuana and didn't work very well with alcohol. He says, I wonder if marijuana will be legal in all 50 states in the next 10 years. Only time will tell. But for those who aren't subscribers, if you want to hear my perspectives on things as it relates to it, we were getting into some broader issues, and it related more, I think, to conspiracies in the news and whatnot, but I'd touched on how I didn't feel that with regard to shooting incidents and gun control laws in the United States, I don't think that taking guns off the streets and making ownership of certain or all firearms illegal, I don't think that's going to solve the gun issue. Many people do think that. My feelings are that you take guns off the streets, people will use pipe bombs, potato guns, pencils, you know, sharpened bicycle spokes removed from wheels, anything that they need to in order to inflict harm and damage on people. You know, a radicalized terrorist in the United States, if they wanted to just mow people down, all they have to do is just hijack a car or use their own, if they have one, and just drive down a city sidewalk. That's the whole thing. People who seek to inflict both harm on individuals and also incite terror, they're going to find a way to do that come hell or high water. And I don't think that, you know, changing gun laws such as removing them from the streets is going to change that. Let's see how many negative iTunes reviews I get for saying that. But I, in seriousness and in honesty, I'm just trying to say that what we need are broader ways of addressing these problems. You know, I don't think that just saying, okay, well, we see people, idiots, who are breaking the law with the guns that they obtain, and often doing so legally, that if we make it illegal to own those guns, that it's going to change anything about how they go about obtaining them or what they intend to do with them. And if you have, for instance, a law that removes guns from being able to be legally purchased or owned, again, is that going to keep a person whose intent is to use that gun to either kill somebody or to rob a bank or do any number of other illegal activities? If their intention is to break the law, will a law set in place that makes it illegal to purchase or own or acquire that weapon prevent them from doing so nonetheless? Hell no. Their intention is going to be to break the law, and so inevitably they will break another law to reach their end game, their end result. So that's the whole point. But again, that's a broader discussion we could have, and I'd rather not have that right now. The second point Mark touches on, he says, you talked about how Nick Pope had been your second guest on the original Graylian Report podcast. That's true. He says, why not for Graylian X subscribers feature old interviews, interesting interviews that would just be the interview, excluding maybe topical material. Maybe we'll think about that. And finally, he asks, have you been dreaming more or just talking about dreams more? This is Carl Jung's birthday, so I have to ask. Keep up the good work. Well, I always dream. And, boy, synchronicity. I mean, or rather, I should say deja vu struck the moment I said that. I don't dream any more than I ever have, but the dreams I've had lately have been very, very visual. And I get emails from people all the time. I wish I had time to get to all of them on this program that have to do with the kinds of dreams people are having. But I always love to hear from them. When I have time, I try to engage people in correspondence about these kinds of things. So if you're someone who's had interesting dreams lately, info@graylianreport.com. Would love to hear from you. You might also try info@micahhanks.com. Sometimes those emails are a little less likely to get lost in the fray than the Graylian emails. I got a lot of emails at the Graylian account, and I unfortunately eventually will probably have to hire an assistant to help with that. But for the time being, the Hadels and the hamsters who are spinning in the little wheel over there keeping the power running down here are going to have to be it. That and, of course, the ever-reliable Graylian gang. Although at times I think I want to say the ever reliable, the ever intermittent Graylian gang. There, that fits a little better. Stephen writes, Micah, I was reading an article that was linked at the Graylian Daily News from naturalblaze.com. I first heard about this last week while listening to Coast on my way to work, and George had had a guest on in the first half of the show. It was Dr. Joel Wallach. And one of the first things that George asked about was the missing doctors. This guy insisted that this was the work of illegal drug cartels. He said that the only other thing all the guys had in common besides holistic medicine was that they all prescribed marijuana. Now, it was funny because George sounded like he wanted the guests to elaborate further, but the doctor ended the subject right there, wouldn't talk anymore. I read all the connected links to the article on your website, and none of them mentioned anything about marijuana or how it may relate to this. I'm not sure how credible the info is, but I just thought I'd pass that along. It's an interesting twist you might not know about. Take care, Stephen Walker. Thanks for that, Steve. I hadn't heard about that, although I will mention that looking into this, and I've just got to be honest with you, I've looked at every site that I can find that has carried information about possible ties between deaths, some of them obvious homicides, of holistic practitioners. Nothing in the mainstream media. All alternative media or blogs that are commenting on articles that have appeared in the alternative media. Snopes.com, one mainstream site, did carry some information. And, you know, they assign status to these claims with the Snopes.com website. Interestingly, rather than it being an article about this that sought to either confirm or debunk the story, what they featured was a long article that dissects this. And what they essentially say is the claims of these deaths, that is, were not unlike the Clinton body count rumor, by which every dead person who had the slightest link to the Clintons were drafted into a broad, vague conspiracy theory. The rumor, like its predecessor, cherry-picked information that fit its narrative while discarding the facts that didn't fit. But they note that there's an update where the Freedom Outpost website had mentioned that there were two more deaths, and the deaths apparently continue. Now, at least in the opinion of the editors at Snopes.com, it is not the case that these deaths are connected. Sadly, I'm not seeing even any commentary on the apparent connections being made by alternative news sites between these deaths. And I certainly, as Stephen had brought to my attention, had not heard the episode of Coast to Coast where someone had said that it all had to do with marijuana and that George Norrie pursuing the matter was shut down by the doctor who had some thoughts about that. But anyway, we'll continue watching the story. If more and more deaths begin to occur, if homicides are connected to any of these, and if it seems at any time apparent that there may be something more going on, we'll certainly report that here on this program. And with that said, I want to get to our guest for tonight. As I had teased earlier, and we're actually going to bridge from the first into the second hour with this interview, but there is an enduring mystery here about the southern United States that has long held my attention, captured my fascination, and although I've never made it to this location, I still hope to go, despite the fact that what you're about to hear may, in truth, offer some entirely new revelations about this particular mystery. It is the Georgia Guidestones, and my guest tonight is a gentleman, Dr. Mike Bennett, who you may know by another name, that of Dr. Future. It's his first time here on the Graylian Report, and I am very pleased to have him here with us, joining us. Mike, how are you?
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm great, and it's wonderful to be here. And this sort of checks off a part of my bucket list, because I always wanted to meet who was behind the Graylian Report. I would run into that all the time over the years, and so that's a feather in the cap for me now to be able to actually be on your show, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, I always am pleased to have a fellow time traveler on the program, and with a name like Dr. Future, I have to presume that that's what you are in part. I'm sure that there's a lot more that you're doing, and in fact, I wanted to give you a minute to talk about that. I'd like to know a little about your background. Actually, I know a little bit. You and I have spoken some before, but for my listeners, if they don't know about you, the radio program you do, and your other work, let's talk a little bit about who you are and how you got into this.
Sure. My background, as far as vocationally, is in the sciences. I was a scientist. Education and my PhD is in mechanical engineering and combustion science.
I like it already.
Chemical engineering and things like that. And I worked for 16 years for the Air Force Research Labs designing fire and explosion protection equipment for military aircraft and about any other vehicle that I could come across, and ran a gun range. We actually shot Russian-type artillery guns into airplanes and blowing them up. And my new F-22 fighter blew it in two, the first one off the line, and a bunch of other things. But mine was more into the weird science of coming up with really, really exotic ways to put out massive explosions with little tiny devices. And from that, after I got my PhD, I was a little Johnny-come-lately and went back to school after 10 years and got it so I could stay competitive on the research front. I had married a woman, another engineer from the South, and as people told me, I would be heading south. And so right after I finished my degree, she desired to move farther south from Dayton, Ohio, to be closer to her parents who were in ill health. And so I had to hang out a shingle, and I became an inventor while I was still doing consulting work in the field. I invented several devices to stop fires and explosions on, for example, police vehicles, NASCAR has actually used some devices I've made, and they use this fire panel device I invented actually on the Humvees and other vehicles in the armor to keep IEDs and RPGs from exploding. And I have a new device coming out called an N2 Tower that's being assembled in Canada to actually put out fires using huge rocket motors.
How fascinating.
And these rocket motors are like airbag inflator type technology, but they're much, much bigger, and they can put out huge fires in rooms. They're safe for the environment and the ozone hole. They make pure nitrogen pyrotechnically, and they've been tested in army vehicles and different applications, aircraft engines. FAA's tested them and things like that. So we'll see where that goes. It's been a long time coming to production, but really, I haven't been involved in that in a number of years. I'm sort of half left brain, half right brain, and I've always enjoyed creative pursuits, and the scientific stuff was sort of the means to the end. And I had produced three feature-length movies, low-budget movies, many, many years ago when I was in school, and was doing different things like that. And then I started the Future Quake radio show in 2005 when I moved here sort of on a lark. A new community radio station started called Radio Free Nashville. And I started having a weekly show on there and got to have people like Alvin Toffler, the futurist, and a number of other famous people. And at some time, it got a little bit more into the religion and spirituality, a little bit more than the comfort level of the station. And so I ended up going over to another radio station that was more into that stuff and had a daily drive time. It was all just a volunteer production that I did. And that continued for 7 years until the station was sold and changed format. And we soldiered on for about another year on the internet. But I really felt a burden to write books and on some topics that were near and dear to my heart. So since 2012, when I hung up my microphone, I've been writing a very, very long-winded book series called The Holy War Chronicles, a Spiritual View of the War on Terror. And it's a six-volume book series that goes back to the fundamentals of how do people use religion to justify taking violent acts and hating other people. And so I'm looking at it from every possible fundamental aspect with the goal of changing hearts and minds. And so I'm just finishing that up. But what we'll talk about today relates to sort of a satellite that a colleague I had come in contact with from my show that's a documentary filmmaker had asked me to help him in a project 5.5 years ago. And it is finally out of the can this summer and has just in the last week been available for procurement related to the Georgia Guidestones. And it was something that went in as sort of a modest project and came out to be something far, far more dramatic that we had no anticipation what was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I got to say now, I've seen the trailer online. It looks really interesting. And I want to just say before we really get into that, I see you and I are very much alike. Books, radio, research, science. In fact, chemistry I love, although all the sciences fascinate me. And so, you know, if I'm ever out there toward Music City, we'll have to catch up. We've got to link up and have coffee. I could probably talk to you for hours, Mike. And I'm going to enjoy the next hour or so talking with you today. So on to the Georgia Guidestones subject. What got you interested in that? Did that precede the actual documentary? I presume it did. Or did this friend approach you and just say, hey, got this thing. What do you think? How did it all start?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Future Quake was about all sorts of weirdness that I love. And when you look at conspiracy stuff and New World Order stuff and things, if you're around any length of time, the Georgia Guidestones just sort of falls in your lap because It's known as America's Stonehenge. It's a subject of countless documentaries on History Channel or Discovery Channel or things like this. And mostly they involve people trying to describe the background of them and basically coming to a standstill and trying to determine who were the mysterious people behind it that produced it. So the ominous warnings on it, some people call them the Ten Commandments of the New World Order, that are marked on it, have always caused awe with people, and particularly the mystery of not knowing who they were. So I was well aware of them. They had come up one reason or another on different shows. But Chris Pinto, who is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and who some of his work, such as Riddles and Stone and others, actually had a pronounced effect on my worldview and political view. And I come from a very, very conservative background, religiously and politically. And the Future Quake process was a process of me reassessing and finding my own way in these matters. And his work, I had always been impressed, while I might not agree with everything, it's all controversial material that he covers. But
sure.
But in these few works, I saw merit in it. But his production quality and artistry is just unparalleled. And when he relocated to the Nashville area here, I was tipped off by one of our guests that he was here, and got to see him regularly at church and a few other things. And he'd been on Future Quake a few times. And then he just mentioned he wanted to do a documentary on the Georgia Guidestones. And this was before I started my book, and I was busy with the radio show. But I thought, boy, this is a great opportunity. He wanted me to appear on camera and help out in different things. But really what was envisioned was it was just going to be more of a comprehensive documentation of the people who were involved, interviewing them, going over what the implications were sociologically, spiritually, of the guidelines and things like this, and doing it in a quality fashion. And that was all we thought it was going to be based on a single trip to Elberton, Georgia, which was where they're located. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out to be we had surprises that literally fell in our lap that you see on camera in the documentary. That totally changed the course, and it became something far, far bigger than what we'd imagined.
That's what I'd wondered is, had you done the research prior to the documentary, or did this stuff all? Because, I mean, I even see in what little is shown in the trailer online for the film, Dark Skies Over Elberton, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Dark Clouds.
Dark Clouds.
Dark Clouds. Dark Clouds Over Elberton, the true story of the Georgia Guidestones.
Excellent. Oh, yeah, I want to make sure I get that name correct. I wondered, from what I see in the trailer, had this research preceded what is appearing on camera, or did this actually unfold as it was happening? And so you indicate that this stuff almost serendipitously comes to light. And I tell you, it seems to indicate, and as you've indicated to me during correspondence, that, I mean, you may have really closed in on some of the mystery behind this. So let's get a little into the history of, as we're leading up to that discussion. And of course, we want people to watch this documentary, so we can't maybe give away all the information here, but I think we'll get into a pretty good conversation about it. But let's talk about the history of the Guidestones. When did they appear? What is some of the mystique that surrounds them for those who have never heard of them? And what are some of the theories about their importance or what role they play, especially as we move forward into the future?
Sure. I'll try to give you a condensed summary. In the summer of 1979, a mysterious gentleman showed up at a major granite quarrying company in Elberton, Georgia, which is, they call themselves the granite capital of the world. They make monuments, they make tombstones, that kind of thing, for the industry. And he shows up and says he wants a monument made, which is not a surprise to these kind of people, until he explained to them that he wanted something that was almost 20 feet tall,
Wow.
A very complex structure. And they immediately thought that he was off his rocker, or they didn't really take him seriously. And he said he had the money to pay for it. And so as he presented more information, but he would not give his name. He would not give who he was. He only called himself R.C. Christian, which he admitted was a pseudonym. And finally, the gentleman, Joe Finley, who was the head of the granite operation there, sent him to the local banker, Wyatt Martin, who would be required to be a conduit to transfer money. And Mr. Martin similarly grilled him to try to find out more about him. And while he seemed to be a very distinguished, dignified individual, he still could not get his name out. And he finally said, look, for us to take money from you by regulation, I'm going to have to know your actual name. And so he sort of put Wyatt Martin to oath, saying that he would not ever tell anyone his name. And So he became the only person to actually know who this mysterious R.C. Christian was, who claimed to represent a small number of like-minded people who were concerned about the future of the world. And so the process began in a very aggressive fashion through the second half of 1979, so just in time for it to be unveiled right on the vernal equinox in March of 1980. With big fanfare, hundreds of people, congressmen speaking there. And this device, it's often called America's Stonehenge, and that's because it has these erect stone slabs or monoliths that give you sort of a general feel of it. But there are these four, I think they're 19 feet tall, with a big slab on top, that have inscribed on them what they call guidelines for the future of humanity. And as I mentioned, some people call them the Ten Commandments of the New World Order, because there are 10 phrases on there that they felt like humanity would have to learn and embrace if it was to survive. And the first one is the one that gets the most attention, which is maintaining Earth's population at 500 million in harmony with nature. And that would be down from our current level of 7 billion. So you're talking less than 10% less. But it also mentions about having a world court system that would have authority over world affairs, a world government, a single language, and some similar guidelines like that, while at the same time reiterating that it would be in harmony with nature. And it concludes by saying, leave room for nature, leave room for nature. And it was written not only in English, but the different sides had most of the major world languages, Russian, Chinese, Arabic, Hebrew, Swahili. So all these different languages are represented with the same guidelines on the different sides. And there are also guidelines or phrases that are done in ancient languages like Babylonian, Egyptian cuneiform, and others that proclaim a goal being the age of reason for humanity. And this was designed to be something that would be a monolith that would last for the ages, for thousands of years. It has other interesting features. There are certain holes that are drilled into it. It's aligned with perfect north and south. It's designed so that on the equinoxes, on the solstices, you can line up the sun through apertures that have been cut through it to basically sort of re-square yourself with where we are in the universe and around the sun. It's lined up with the North Star. You can see the North Star at any time of the year. And there's also on the ground a plate on the ground that actually mentions a time capsule 6 feet below that doesn't have any date on when it's to be opened. But it gives some information about the originators of the Gadstones, and it refers to the name R.C. Christian being a pseudonym for them. So that's basically the complex itself outside in rural Elberton, about an hour and a half due east of Atlanta, close to the South Carolina border. And it's just an enigma. It's a huge tourist attraction. People come from everywhere and ponder who are the people that want us to reduce our population and have basically a globally organized government and things like that. And that's why there's been so many documentaries and things, but nobody's been able to crack the case in and out to figure out who these people were, what maybe that motivated them for it.
That is really, really interesting stuff. When we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about R.C. Christian. There have been a lot of theories about who that may be, what his motivations had been. Is this really something that's talking about reducing world populations, maybe by a means that wouldn't be to the benefit of those being removed? We'll talk about that with Mike when we return here on the Graylin Report.
so politics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gringian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And welcome back. I'm Micah Hanks. This, of course, is the Gringian Report, continuing our discussion with Dr. Mike Bennett. And Mike has been telling us about what is some groundbreaking research he's been doing into the Georgia Guidestones. I was invited a while back by a friend to head down there, and we've yet to make the trip. But I can't help but think that now, already, I'm wanting to get down there. But as Mike kind of alluded to already before this conversation, and we're going to no doubt get into that with him during this hour, there are a lot of questions about this that he and Chris and the others have been working together on this documentary. Dark Clouds Over Elberton is the name of it. There are some things that they have unraveled about the Georgia Guidestones that they feel, first of all, has never been talked about before. And, of course, which also may have some darker connotations. I don't want to give too much away. And, of course, I haven't been debriefed on this in advance, so that you're going to hear about this just as I do. And so, as we're coming back to things, we'll get right back into it with Dr. Mike, because I want to know a few things about where, you know, some of the specifics that led them to finding more about this enigmatic R.C. Christian, the man who has long been attributed to being the working force behind the Georgia Guidestones. And so I want to continue the discussion with you, Mike, about how you unraveled some of the information about who you believe R.C. Christian was.
I'll be very liberal in sharing some of that information with people, although we'd like them to get the documentary. People want answers, so we'll cover some specifics on that, Micah. But one thing I was going to mention to you and to really shed more light on R.C. Christian, were you aware that he had written a book that further elaborated his views in the Guidestones?
I don't think I was, although the candle of recognition is almost flickering in the back of my mind, because I know that there's a newspaper editor who my friend Jim Harold had been in touch with, who knows a lot about this, and I seem to recall the gentleman, you may know him, his name slips my mind, but he had possibly mentioned something like this. Now, was the book written under the pseudonym?
Yes, Robert Christian is actually what it was used.
Okay.
And I do have a copy of the book. It's only been mentioned once or twice in a few things I'm aware of. Most of the time people have mentioned that it was at the Elberton Library. Mm-hmm. There were a few copies still for sale at the Elberton Granite Museum, and I procured one of them. It's called Common Sense Renewed, and it was first published in 1986 and then republished in 1990. And the book's 128 pages, and it elaborates in detail on the philosophy of the gentleman who claims to be R.C. Christian. Hmm. And he mentions that the first copies of this book were sent to all members of Congress and other world leaders so that it would actually influence what their perspective was. But some of the things that he says, if you want me just to sort of glance over a few things.
Please do.
From the book, he mentions about it at the time being the harvest time of his life. But there's an emphasis on reason. He says, don't permit your judgment to be overwhelmed by unreasoning faith in a manner that ignores honest evidence. He says, we must unite with the entire human family in establishing a limited world government capable of settling international disputes through a system of law. And he desires that this age of reason be achieved in the lifetime of today's children. He says, for more than 60 years, I've benefited from American political system. Some of his ancestors participated in major wars. He talks about our instincts being derived from 2 years of evolution, 2 billion years of evolution, that were intended to improve our species. However, we've not regulated our numbers and not used the rule of law in controlling major aggression. And he talks, he has major chapters about wanting to unite the U.S. and the Soviet Union as political partners. And you have to remember, this was done still through the height of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. It still had another decade to go by the time this was done. He mentions that human intelligence could provide solutions for population control or for perfecting our species as the shepherd of life on Earth, which very much is like a eugenics or even a transhumanism type perspective.
Sort of seems to be.
But he acknowledges on page 4, he says, I recognize the differences which separate my understanding of reality from that of religionists who interpret the Bible and other ancient documents in a literal fashion. So while on one hand he tells people he is a Christian, he has a very open-minded view of what that is, and it's really more of a science-based belief with spiritual issues sort of taking a back seat on it.
Hmm.
He says, I'm the originator of the Georgia Guidestones and the sole author of its inscriptions. I've had the assistance of a number of other American citizens in bringing the monument into being. And he mentions a few of the people like Wyatt Martin, who also helped on the ground and at Elberton. But he spends most of the time talking about that each national government needs a population policy. He says this is urgent and should take precedence over other problems, even those related to national defense. No nation having regulated its own population should be expected to burden its citizens with the unwanted surplus of its improvident neighbors. In other words, he means immigration from surrounding countries. He says a few generations of single-child families will make possible dramatic improvements of living standards. He talks about abortion, the controversy of using abortion, you know, as a mean to control population. But he says some strange things, being a very, very skilled scientist in terms of his knowledge. He talks about a rationale that in early in gestation of pregnancy, because the human fetus looks like other animals in its early stages, that he gives that as a justification for killing it.
Huh.
Because it's not, just because it physically resembles sort of a non-human kind of thing.
That's kind of odd.
it is odd. He talks about a common new engineered language, one thing he mentions, and he mentions this more than once, including on the last page of the book, that 500 million people may still be too many. That they will find out that maybe Earth can't even handle that. But he adds in here on page 28 that he discourages reproduction of people of those carrying human disorders, and he believes in positive eugenics for breeding extra capable people. Also forcing people with good genes to transfer their kids to good parents to domesticate our species. He limits the right to vote to people who are more enlightened than other people for voting. He says there should be world identity cards. Anyway, it goes on with things like this, rationing the care that we can afford to give to people who aren't valuable anymore to the world. And so, but he says all this wrapped in a lot of science.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of objectivity that sounds as if his attempt is to try to save the world.
It sounds very much like he is crusading to do, had been doing that. But, you know, especially when eugenics is one thing, and I have my own feelings about that. And frankly, I'm hearing some of that stuff, and it's a little unsettling, maybe more than a little unsettling. And then I hear him also mentioning, the voting issue. This has been a really contentious thing, for years for people. You know, the idea that whether or not necessarily intended, there have been circumstances that have prevented certain individuals from having equal access to voting. And it seems that he was an advocate of that very sort of a thing, which I got to say, let's be honest, in the past, there have been a lot of prominent individuals. It's very seldom spoken, but, I guess what you might call a sort of positive eugenics was advocated by Nikola Tesla, obviously Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., the Supreme Court Justice, and many others, especially in the early part of the last century, had really advocated that same sort of a thing, which made it no less controversial. And I just don't know, where I mean, what are your feelings, Mike? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but, just your general thoughts.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah.
Funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. I mean, there were even churches that would actually have people, you could come in and have your relatives sterilized for these same reasons as well, too. When you read it overall, I believe this gentleman was well-meaning in that he thought situations were so dire in terms of limited resources that he was suggesting desperate means to save the world. But he does it very, very objectively without really even mentioning. He says, well, it might be unpalatable or distasteful to some, but there's no sympathy or empathy for those who fall outside his circle, who don't make the cut, to stay. There's no really mention about what their rights might be or things like this. You know, it's you can have some sympathies. We're talking about things like controlling people's vote. In fact, he even talks about it by the second grade, deciding whether people are cut out for professional careers and education or be sent them into trade school as soon as then to separate them. You know, I am a practicing Christian, and so, you know, I don't accept all the crazy stuff you see by the institutional stuff that really is a deviation from the founder of the faith, which is pretty widespread. But having said that, when I see this general approach and sort of a relatively callous approach, at the same time, I understand that sustainability is not a bad word. We have an earth with limited resources, and we need to be prudent in how responsible we are in, you know, the size of our families, our overall footprint that we have on this earth, how much we take of the resources, because we're really robbing it from somebody else.
You're absolutely
just
right.
Because somebody happened to be born in the third world and they don't have access to these things, what right do I have? I mean, it betrays my own religious faith and the golden rule to say I have a divine right because I was born in America to use up a lot of the energy and other resources over somebody else.
Of course, we have certain responsibilities. I don't mean to interrupt you, by the way, but I mean I wanted to insert that in the first hour of tonight's show, I actually talked about this recent Tech Times article where the forecast for the future at one time, I think, as recently as 1972, it was believed that human life would reach the limits of sustainability by around the year 2050. And that's been extended now to the year 2100. But that still says that within the next century, human life runs a dire risk of eliminating itself as a result of all such things as overpopulation and the like. So absolutely, we have to deal with the issues of scarcity, overpopulation, and these kind of things. You know, where I would differ, of course, with what Christian was writing, one of the many places I think I would be where, you know, we're talking about if we can determine whether somebody as early as second grade is going to be fit for the business world. I know if they'd looked at me when I was in second grade, I might have been a couple of reading levels ahead of the other kids in the class. But by around the time high school came around, I was pretty much just a guitar guy. I wanted to play guitar all day. Mm-hmm. It was funny. I didn't do as well in high school as I could have if I had applied myself. But years after graduation, you know, you get your head on straight. I still play guitar. I still play music for part of my profession. But I see that unlike a lot of people I went to school with, I've made more opportunities for myself by trying to be creative and trying to educate myself. And maybe it's just not fair, using myself as an example, not to try and put myself on a pedestal. It's certainly not that. But to be fair, maybe a second grader, you know, shouldn't be prejudged. I wouldn't have wanted to be prejudged. And so, you know, I can see that his intentions were obviously good. And we do have to address the real issues about overpopulation. But, you know, it seems maybe some of his thought process was a little extreme just as well.
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, I agree with you. We do have a collective responsibility to each other. And I believe the golden rule is a foundation that that dictates all of this. But then you get to the question when the technocracy, even though it may be as well-meaning, whether it's from H.G. Wells and his ilk and Fabian Socials up to now, who want to sort of take the bull by the horns and say we're going to make it happen one way or the other for the sake of our race. The question is, who's authorized to make some of those decisions?
Yeah.
Who's in and who's out? It reminds me of an old movie, Abandoned Ship, which was a variation of the movie Lifeboat, where a man who's on board a small little rescue boat with survivors. There's too many survivors. And he starts making arbitrary calls on who to throw overboard into the waves.
Yeah.
And there's a debate on, well, who authorized you to the one to make the call? And those are good questions to be able to ask. And technocrats, and I'm saying this as a technical scientist person myself,
sure,
tend to put this mantle on themselves of being the enlightened people society who have every right to make that call. And voila, they actually choose people of their own ilk to actually be the people they think are most likely best suited to retain and survive. And so I believe that we need to educate ourselves of our responsibility to each other to voluntarily make sure our families are limits that we can actually be independent, self-sufficient, not a burden on others. But when we start the draconian kind of things, that's to me where it gets to be an issue.
Yeah.
And that's where when we talk about, limiting what people vote, who votes. You know, most of us have actually seen these nitwits on TV that don't even know who our existing president is or any of these other people, and their votes count just as much. They go in and pick people with sound bites after the debates and really people who don't have any kind of long-term vision for our future. But they go with these folk, and it's all crossed our minds probably, boy, why should those people get a vote like the rest of us? And that elitism is so seductive to come in. And like you said about yourself, you know, even if your parents had exhibited some traits you had, they may have been sterilized and you may not even had a chance to turn out to be who you were at this time. Albert Einstein would have been emptying garbage because I believe he was sort of a deadbeat, you know, at a young age. A lot of our most brilliant people were ones who couldn't focus in school.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do much. So this is a little moral to the story. We talk about it a little bit in the documentary, but a lot of this kind of thing becomes sort of self-evident to an enlightened viewer. The big thing we do is focusing on discovering who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some dark aspects to his association when we learn who apparently the real person is that put like a little dark edge on, even if you try to give this fellow a benefit of the doubt on what he's writing. But this book is something few people know about, but it further reinforced that we had the right guy with the data that we came across. And it's a lot more than 10 brief phrases in granite to be able to understand the direction that he's going.
Boy, this is really, really turning out to be an interesting conversation here. Dr. Mike Bennett is my guest. Of course, he's the fellow behind Future Quake and also one of the several individuals behind this documentary, Dark Clouds Over Elberton. And as we're continuing this conversation, I think we've gotten a much more in-depth view of in terms of the ideology and the attitudes of this R.C. Christian individual as related in this book. And who knew, trying to discern all this stuff from the Godstones themselves, that there had been a tract retreatist that actually much more clearly elucidated some of his ideas. I think Mike and I and many others who are listening probably wouldn't necessarily agree with all of them, and yet there is as meaningful a debate being brought to the table in relation to all that as any that you would see in relation to the future forecasts for humanity. We obviously face some issues. Before we go to a break, let's go ahead and kind of get into a bit of the discussion about how you began to, throughout the course of this documentary, how you began to unravel some of the clues about who he was and how this information made its way to you. I understand sometimes these things can be kind of serendipitous.
That's the perfect word to choose for this. And of course, you know, in hindsight, we wondered when we marveled at where the journey took us, we wondered if it was a God thing. But whatever words you want to use, there was something unanticipated. And don't let me forget later in the discussion, because this book that I quote, once we find other smoking gun evidence, the inside cover of this book gives another piece of hard data right in front of everybody's eyes that nobody seems to have followed up with. It'll dovetail in our results. But we arranged, when we began our trip to Elberton, to, first of all, my job was to go try to find out who were all the key figures of one form or another that played a role in erecting the Godstones in Elberton, and arranging, locating them, finding out where they were, if they were still living, and arrange for them to give us an interview and to really document holistically everything that was involved with this guy, any insight he shared about himself. One of the ones that was a real coup that we were able to get was Wyatt Martin himself, the banker and the only man who claims to know the identity of R.C. Christian. And he had since moved away from town elsewhere into Georgia, and we drove down to his location, and he's quite old. His health is tenuous, but he was strong in spirit, even though he was sort of weak physically. And we had a rousing, lengthy discussion, finding out whatever we could, although he would not tell us the name of R.C. Christian. And he didn't. He says he did not bother to ask Mr. Christian a lot of his motivation. And a recurring theme we found amongst the residents there is that, in fact, would give a sort of a blanket description of the key figures in the town. Most of them were church-going types, went to the Baptist church or something similar, very active in their faith. And most of them, although Wyatt Martin was not, but the other key figures being stonemasons, they were also high-level Freemasons, 33rd degree Freemasons, which is probably a convenient thing if you need people to keep quiet about things.
Yeah.
But they did not see any kind of discrepancy between what was being said on these stones and what their own personal faith was. They hadn't really processed it. And really the common theme was they were excited that this would bring attention to Elberton, would help the granite industry, would become a tourist attraction. And they really wanted to promote the mystery of the Gadstones by keeping that interest in the public. But as we began talking to Wyatt Martin and had a long interview with him, scrubbing everything we could, we asked him about something we'd noticed in a Wired magazine article, that there was a mention of a computer case that he had, like a hard case, like you'd have a typewriter in, that he had kept the letters and other documents from R.C. Christian. And he would not allow them to see that. He would even confirm whether he had destroyed them or not. We saw another reference that had said that they had been destroyed. And when I had culled together a lot of these different documents and tried to come up with as much knowledge as we could to put together an informed interview, this sort of came out, and we asked him about that case.
Hmm.
And he mentioned, this is all real time on camera, you can watch in the documentary, and he did admit that it existed. And we asked him if he'd destroyed it, and he said no. He said he had intended to destroy it, but hadn't gotten around to it. And we asked him if we could see it, and he said no, initially. But as we talk later, and you can watch this again, it's real time on camera, it's very dramatic. He finally concedes to let us see the case itself. And so we marched right outside with the camera rolling through his house and out to the shed in the back, this little tiny shed. And Mr. Pinto deputized me to go back to crawl around in all the junk and body surf back in there to find this case and try to drag it back out. And sure enough, there is this big brown, hard, durable case that he claims to have the information in it.
Oh, wow.
And we talk and we chat casually about it. And you just watch it on camera. And, you know, he talks about how he maybe had intended to write a book about it and then decided he was too old. And we chatted all around it. And finally, after a lengthy discussion listening to Mr. Martin, we asked him if there was any way we could see the inside just to confirm that it was what he claimed. And eventually he agreed.
He agreed to let you open this case. Listen, hold that.
That no one had ever seen before.
Right? Wow. Hold that thought, because when we come back from this break, I want to hear about that. Boy, talk about a cliffhanger right there. What was in this case? I'm going to ask Mike Bennett about that when we come back here on the Graylian Report. A truly fascinating discussion. Dark Clouds Over Elberton is the documentary. We're going to learn more about the contents of that mysterious case when we come back. Stay with us.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida.
High mountains of Appalachia. This is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we're having a very interesting conversation with Mike Bennett tonight about the Georgia Guidestones and some stuff that I'm quite confident that most of us have never heard. In fact, maybe something that no one up until right now, apart from these gentlemen who were involved with the making of this documentary, Dark Clouds Over Elberton, had known. Where we left off in the last segment, Mike's already promised me this is going to get really interesting. So we'll take all the time we need to put together this entire story. We had a very interesting briefcase that was about to be opened that may contain some very interesting and revelatory information about this individual, R.C. Christian, the man who is at the epicenter of this Guidestones mystery. Now, Mike, as we left off discussing that, this briefcase was about to be opened. What happens next?
Right. And, you know, this is one scenario that you see in the documentary. It's a two-hour documentary. There's a number of them where this whole production is as much drama as it is documentary, because all of this is happening real time on camera as we're first discovering it. And you can almost feel like a Hitchcock type of tension where the viewer is saying, open the case, please open the case. We want to see what's in the case. And it requires a lot of patience to sort of build the rapport, to give him the feeling, you know, this is probably his last chance to show the world that this is there.
Yeah.
At his advanced age. In fact, I don't even know as of today if he's still with us. But this was the one chance. In fact, this case had never been viewed by anybody else other than himself before. So it was the first time it was there, and I believe he had opened it for 12 years before we saw it. And so all of these secrets are just locked up in the back of a shed over this world mystery. And when he opened it up, Mr. Pinto had asked permission to film, you know, the contents, to lean in there and see it. And so I know he was doing an aggressive scan of everything that fell in the viewfinder. Same way with I standing over the top. I was the one actually opening the case with Mr. Martin there. And he sort of noses around through some items there, and he finds a letter from R.C. Christian that he proceeds to read to us. And I'm looking over his shoulder seeing this letter, and it's signed with some kind of script, R.C. Christian, at the bottom. And I immediately, I'm just trying to grab evidence. And the letter's dated 1998, and he mentions in this letter that he was 78 years old, that he had experienced the Dust Bowl, you know, in the Corn Belt and these other issues. So I'm logging all this in my mind, and he conveniently showed this letter to, at the request of Mr. Pinto, to the camera, so the viewer can watch, see this letter too, from the real R.C. Christian. And so he shares some of these pieces of data. He lifts up a package that was for the Smithsonian, and it turned out that Mr. Martin had a much more active role in addition to just making sure this thing was built as a proxy in Elberton. He also helped Mr. Christian and some of his other associates that helped him build this. Wyatt Martin had also helped be a proxy to forward basically press releases and packages to prominent publications about it. Uh-huh. And one of them we saw was from the Smithsonian, and it had a name written on it. It says care of, and it had a gentleman's name, last name, for R.C. Christian. And immediately I made a mental note of that, and fortunately we got it in the camera. So we have a name, some mysterious name, that is somewhere in the chain of helping get this information out to people. And so he gives us just a very brief glimpse for a short time. He's thumbing through a few things, and as he lists some documents, I see an address. And I see a real address, and it's an address in Iowa, and it's a medium-sized city in Iowa. And I put to memory the address. And we found out far later, after we reviewed the footage, that the address actually popped up on camera.
Oh.
Now, it turned out it was upside down. We had to flip it, but yeah, it was preserved on camera. And then he decided to close the package, close the box, and that was it. That was our exposure. Yeah. But what we left with beyond the interview, for the first time in anybody's eyes had seen, a name and an address tied to Iowa with this package that had just R.C. Christian originated material.
Hmm.
To- totally unanticipated, not expected, and we will follow up on that as we go from there. But we had some other interesting things happen to us as we interviewed the other figures. Now, you have to understand that nobody understood or knew what we had just witnessed and what we were privy to knowledge of.
Including the gentleman purportedly, who, or I assume, the fellow who showed you this information, right?
Well, we at the time, you know, we really didn't ask and quiz. Uh-huh. He's the one that lifted the information to be able to reveal the stuff. Okay. Of course, we knew he wasn't going to tangibly, obviously show it to us because he said he'd said he would not. Whether he intended to show it to us or not, I guess we'll never know. But the information, we had given permission for us to use the material that was shown, and there it was there right in front of our eyes. And so we interviewed the other key figures in Elberton that had all played a role, and they all described. One gentleman actually met R.C. Christian, but did not know his name. He was instructed not to ask him, but he met him shortly after it was constructed when he was in town to sort of look at the structure and inspect it. And he explained that the gentleman had sort of an upper Midwestern accent. The same way as Wyatt Martin, talked about the guy being an expert on botany, and he used all of the Latin phrases for all of the animals and plants and things like that, and seemed to be a real expert. He went to these nature preserves, and he was flying back and forth. And Wyatt Martin said that he was in a very, very respectable profession that people would respect. And so as we interview the different characters that were involved, one of the people we interviewed was a gentleman named Wayne Mullinex, who the reason he got involved was he had some property that eventually Mr. Christian, when he decided to build it close to the quarry, he wanted some place that was elevated with a long view so they could get all of their astronomical alignments. And this belonged to a man. These people are all integrated with each other in a small town. You know, they all know each other. And this gentleman also did backhoe type work where he would do foundations and this kind of thing. And so they made arrangements for him to sell some property to build it. And in exchange, he also got to build the foundation and dig underneath for where the structure was placed. And so we interviewed him. Very pleasant guy, just regular Southern charm. But what really got interesting is we asked him about the time capsule. And we asked him about the time capsule being down there. And he seemed to suggest with a grin on his face that there indeed was one down there. Now, this plate on the ground was described by Mr. Martin, I believe it was Mr. Martin, as a burial cover.
Okay.
Or a grave cover, gravesite cover. And I believe he mentioned it the same way, too. People can watch it on the documentary and confirm this, but which is a curious way to describe something like that. And we asked him what was down there, and, you know, he intimated something was there, and we asked him if he would tell us what it was, and he said he would not tell us. And we noted that there was no mark on there when the time capsule was to be opened. And if he knew, and he sort of suggested he knew, but he didn't really know the real date. And he says, do you know who does know? And he mentioned the one gentleman who actually was deceased would know. And we said, is somebody else supposed to come and open this? And he sort of suggested yes. But he never really wanted to give an answer. He just sort of gave us a grin. And so We found this very interesting, but the thing that he also did was he identified another gentleman that has gotten virtually no press and almost no one knows was involved in it. It was a gentleman named Frank Coggins. Frank Coggins just died, I think, last year, but we had a chance to interview him, and he was said to be at the time one of the wealthiest men in Georgia. And in fact, when we went to his home, this opulent home that he lived in with all these marble statues and columns and things. He basically owned the granite industry there in that area virtually. And a number of cities that he'd built in resort cities and communities in Georgia with his money. And he was on oxygen, very poor health. But we went in and we saw pictures of him with Rosalind Carter and these other famous figures. And we began talking to him to find out his role. And it appears, although he sort of was unambiguous about his role in purchasing the land. We got other data that seems to suggest he did actually purchase the land that was involved, but he was very much a key figure in helping promote and getting this done, hiring PR firms to promote it. They had talked about actually even, you know, getting Gene Dixon and some of these other mysterious people in the paranormal to be part of the kickoff and things. But the key thing that he provided to us that was very important was he gave us permission to go look at the construction documents from the hand of R.C. Christian to them directly in his office.
Oh, okay.
And so we drove to his office where his secretary, who really pretty much ran the operations for all his businesses, she turned over to us for our inspection the actual folders that had been there since 1980 of all of the guidelines from R.C. Christian through Wyatt Martin to the builders on how he wanted the Gadstones built. And this was a treasure trove no one had ever seen. And it had, I'll just mention a few things that come to mind that were intriguing.
Yeah.
Looking over at his hand-drawn pictures of the Gadstones and the way he'd had them designed, he had one drawing, well, he had several mentions of building outer rings that would go outside the Gadstones with moonstones that would symbolize certain other astrological or other astronomical features. And there was some addition, some other markings that were supposed to be done in the Gadstones that he noted for the Atlanta Masons. Again, we don't know what that was, but the Atlanta Masons evidently had some vested interest in this. He also mentioned that there was an original pyramidal top designed to go on top that had been omitted because of cost. And at one time I had seen that pyramidal top in one of the documents, and we could not stay there very long, so we had to ask the secretary to send us copies. And for some reason, that particular document was not in there. But as we went back and looked through the original footage at the kickoff, there was a television program done when it was first unveiled in 1980. And sure enough, they showed the model that R.C. Christian brought, and it has that little pyramidal top on it, which is very much more of a metaphysical kind of thing. You know, a lot of people have assumed that he had Rosicrucian connections and where the R.C. Christian came from.
Right, yeah.
And the pyramid would be consistent with that. But the most fascinating thing we found with this huge set of letters and drawings directly from R.C. Christian, and by the way, the handwriting, everything looked identical to what we had seen in Wyatt Martin's case, was this mysterious one-page letter that was typewritten. And it says something fascinating in it, and it was right with all the construction documents. And this document... I went back and emailed the woman who provided this to us to make sure that in writing we had that this indeed came from the construction folder. And I also asked her if she knew who had done it or had put it in here. And she confirmed that it was in the same construction folder that she still had, but could not confirm who had written it or how it got here. But if you want, I can share with you some lines from it.
Yeah, why not?
They're very, very interesting. Now, again, remember, this was in... with the construction documents, it's this letter says, "To whomever comes upon this presenting, contained herein are keys that have been awaited to be placed here in proper sequencing and in proper order to announce the return and the activation of those events of prophecy that signal these events. Those who have guarded this great mystery and who have guarded the evolution of the human species itself are returning. It has begun. This monument, known as the Georgia Gadstones, shall find threads unto the revelation of its mystery in the name R.C. Christian, otherwise known unto that contingency that is responsible for the erection of this monument as Christian Rosencrantz."
Ah.
This presentation of keys upon the finding of it is to be delivered to the Elberton Star, which is their local newspaper. The Elberton Star is to deliver it to the Atlanta Rosicrucian Society.
Oh.
The Rosicrucian. The Rosicrucian contract number is 1. That number is derived from the synchronistic mystery of 404-294-4172 in Atlanta. Now, I decided to see if that was actually a telephone number and called that number. And when I picked up the phone, It said Rosicrucian Society of Atlanta.
Wow.
It continues to say it is only those with the understanding of the rose and its return who will be capable of deciphering the codes and the keys that are contained herein. Unto this great mystery shall in due time be unveiled, likened unto she whose great portal reads only, Know thyself. Unto the unveiling of her wisdom shall indeed come the bridegroom wearing the knowledge of the perfect blending of the red, the white, to bring forth the gold and thus the purity of the rose. It shall bloom again. This monument has now been activated by that which was to come forth into its activation and technological understanding, and many shall come forth into this portal to awaken and to be thusly activated. You are greatly loved, mankind. Once we saw through a glass darkly, but soon we shall see face to face. Do not fear. We are with you through the coming changes.
Wow. Unbelievable. So there's this Rosicrucian connection, which, of course, obviously, I guess, in popular literature, we would identify as one of many secret societies, organizations that operates, and, of course, their direct relevance to the Georgia Guidestones. Boy, I could only liken this to being something the likes of which you would expect to see in a film like The Da Vinci Code.
Well, that's how I described it, because all of this happened real time, and these were, you know, these are these kind of Shazam kind of things when you see it. Now, to be fair and to try to maintain factually, we do not know the origin of how this got into construction documents. Hmm. And the Mr. Coggins' right-hand person who was the gatekeeper for this could not confirm it either, only that it was there. And so that leaves some mystery on, is this something that maybe is down in the time capsule?
And that has yet to be opened, of course.
That is yet to be opened.
Okay. Is that your next objective, by chance?
Well, I say you say you want to go down there. Let's go get some ground-penetrating radar and go down there and check it out.
There you go.
Now, I mentioned to you that there was a name in the case, and there also was an address.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the name that was in the case, we got verification in a surprising way, because I did something that should be a natural consequence of investigators, but it apparently hadn't been done before. I went and looked up the publisher of the book Common Sense Renewed, which, by the way, also was in Iowa, and contacted them, and I asked them who published this book and did this book. And he immediately mentioned the name, the very name of the man whose name was in Wyatt Martin's box.
Really?
And we thought, bingo. When I call this gentleman and he says this, he says, oh, yeah, he did it. Turned out that the publishing house listed in this publication bought out the gentleman that we're talking about. He had his own smaller publishing house, and the copyrights are in both in the name of both publishers. The name Robert Christian is still used, but the gentleman who was in the case had an original publishing firm that first published this, and then was in business with the gentleman I talked to that confirmed that this other gentleman had originated this. And so we thought maybe we're onto the right guy. Now, this book was first published in 86 and republished in 90. So, armed with the full name, first and last name, I was able to obtain an obituary. And it turned out, this guy wrote this in Mason City, of all places.
That's
or
funny.
Was published there, published in Mason City. But he originated in the same medium-sized city that was on the address in the book.
Uh-huh.
A different city in Iowa. But it was the same place. And but the perplexing thing was that the address did not line up with this man's name. His obituary that I was able to find showed that he had died in 1992, which is before the last letters that Wyatt Martin received.
Right.
I mentioned to you there was a 1998 letter he read.
Yeah.
He said the last contact he'd had was shortly after 911. And a few years before we had interviewed Wyatt Martin in 2010, he had said that R.C. Christian's son had contacted him and told him that his father had died a few years ago.
Hmm.
So this was far later than when this gentleman died. So we had a decoupling there. even though it was tied to the same exact town in Iowa. This gentleman who was responsible for having this book published, and by the way, we had another collaborator of his that we were able to interview on camera, and he also confirmed that this gentleman was responsible for this book and confirmed it on camera. But this gentleman was the head of the newspaper in this medium-sized city in Iowa. And he also, within a decade prior to the Gadstones, he was the head of the Iowa Daily Newspaper Association. So this was not a trivial gentleman in his involvement.
Say the least.
That was not the whole story. Yeah. Now, the address that we obtained led to another gentleman who apparently is the real R.C. Christian.
Really?
And this gentleman was a true Renaissance man. He was a renowned surgeon that was known throughout the medical industry. He was a real city father in his city, but he also was a prominent inventor. And as an inventor myself, who has numerous patents myself, I really respect the fact that so many diverse and broad areas he received patents. Now, one of his patents I found was in the area of a way to face and finish concrete. And in one of the actual letters from R.C. Christian, we see him mention that he was once a concrete worker.
Ah.
So there's a connection there.
Absolutely.
He had diverse patents for things for sailboats to improve them, things for the over-the-road transportation industry, solid food material distribution industry. But one of them I have is for a new kind of rotary engine that's very similar to a Wankel rotary engine, mm-hmm. a very fundamental breakthrough. And he filed for this patent with his name under the address that we had located from Wyatt Martin's case, and it was filed 2 months prior to him meeting the people in Elberton. So we could tie a fixed name and an address 2 months before he began this process. I was also able to find, as far as 2002, that this gentleman still lived at the same address with a published account of his campaign contributions.
Interesting.
To some politicians. So through the entire period before and after the Gadstones, during his sustained communication with Wyatt Martin, the same gentleman was at the same address. His obituary showed that he had died in 2005.
Yeah.
So everything seems to add up very, very well. The upper Midwestern accent. But his other thing he was famous for was that he was very famous in the conservation field. And in fact, he had gotten the 1980 Iowa Conservation Award for his contributions to conservation. And on the Gadstones, you read things like leave room for nature, population in harmony with nature. And this was the big recurring theme in his book that he wrote as well, too. But we got more and more data that I was able to find that showed this connection with this nature and trying to make sure we were in harmony with it to survive. But one real dark turn I found in my research that I was able to follow up with in his hometown was I found a letter from, I believe it's the Orlando newspaper, the Sun Sentinel,
sure.
in 1992, when a editorial writer there had written about, this editorial writer was complaining about people who basically didn't care about people outside of America and only wanted to solve America's problems to the detriment of immigrants and others. So then the editorial writer proceeds. It says that this gentleman, who we know as R.C. Christian mm-hmm. from Iowa, says that Patrick Buchanan and David Duke are the few public figures who speak for American interest in this new era of internationalism. He says that the gentleman says that Duke voices many beliefs held by reasonable Americans. It is unfortunate that more acceptable public figures are not pushing similar views. And then he speaks against why there should be strict limits on immigration because of the environment and that America can absorb more people and on. But here he is singing the praises of David Duke, which I'm sure you know and probably most of your listeners. he first came to fame nationwide for marching around in a Nazi uniform on campus, and later became a Grand Wizard in the Ku Klux Klan. And also, by the way, was elected for one term in the Louisiana Congress in the state of Louisiana, ran for governor, and is still around doing his thing. But before I shared that with some of the people that knew this gentleman in the town in Iowa that we went to actually follow up on these identities, we met with the town historian at their public library and another gentleman, an older gentleman who had known these families for many, many decades and was in the social circles of these gentlemen. And we were interviewing this gentleman, Mr. Doan. Before we shared any of this, he says, by the way, this fella used to brag at the country club. Now, this is a prominent surgeon, okay? Yeah. Very well-known city father. He would brag around the country club about his support for David Duke.
Oh, my God.
And I said, really? He says, oh, yeah. He talked about how great David Duke really understood the problem with the races and you know, the difference in capabilities and such.
Okay, and hold then, on. We'll go ahead and finish, then I have a question for you, Mike.
Well, and then I presented this article to this gentleman that showed, you know, the same gentleman was doing this in national newspapers, saying these things. And then I revealed to them the alternative identity of these two gentlemen and their responsibility for the Georgia Guidestones. And these people were just absolutely taken aback. While they could see the obvious connection between what was being written and how it made itself manifest in the Guidestones, the fact that these guys had a secret life on the side, these city fathers, just dumbfounded them. And the historian actually provided us some additional information on the man we know as R.C. Christian. And one of his biographies that he had, and I think it was more for the medical industry where they profiled like a who's who. Uh-huh. And this gentleman said that his biggest concern in his guise as a physician was overpopulation and addressing overpopulation and making extreme measures in society to address it as the most pressing issue, which was exactly the first issue that R.C. Christian had. And he was so well known, I think I mentioned that he was had been awarded a conservation award in Iowa and had written a book about planning the future of Iowa in a sustainable fashion and actually buying land and creating our artificial cities that would be controlled. But even on his tombstone, we went to his tombstone, and it actually shows the word he used to describe himself was conservationist. So the man that we feel like we've confirmed is R.C. Christian, whose personal address was in Wyatt Martin's case with the letters from R.C. Christian, espoused basically identical views to the letters and the writing of R.C. Christian.
And had apparently endorsed and supported guys like David Duke, which brings to mind a disturbing question. With what, as you'd said, maybe the physician that you're discussing, the man, the individual you believe is R.C. Christian, which all the evidence based on what you're presenting here seems to point toward, if the views of guys like Duke had seemed to resonate with him, I wonder if in any way, whether it was ever written or recorded as such, if his views toward population control in any way reflected that. I mean, it does seem to be a rather disturbing turn that has taken.
Well, population control was a main focus in writing we have from the man known in Iowa, who we also believe is R.C. Christian. R.C. Christian's writing under the pseudonym of R.C. Christian has the same priorities as well, too.
Yeah.
But there was another name that came out that was very interesting. This same gentleman, William Sales Doan, that we interviewed, that had known these families of these two gentlemen for decades, actually asked us if we had found evidence of an association with William Shockley. And I don't know if you know who William Shockley is.
Remind me.
He is a Nobel laureate, and he is known as the inventor of the transistor. He basically single-handedly created Silicon Valley. And the computer age that we have came from William Shockley. He was lauded around the world, again, Nobel laureate, but I think it was in the 70s, and beyond, he became better known or notorious for pushing racial segregation and white supremacy.
Oh my God.
And showing the low IQ of what he thought the African American community was, and that there should be forced sterilization of these races that are bringing down the white race, and a clear genetic separation with the races, which made him a pariah. But Mr. Doan, that we interviewed, had said that this gentleman, we alleged R.C. Christian, would brag about his close association with this Nobel laureate, William Shockley, and bragged about it quite a bit, and asked us, you know, if we had known about that. And we did some further research on his suggesting, and found out, in fact, that David Duke's autobiography that he wrote a few years ago was dedicated to his close friend, William Shockley.
Well, I tell you, this has just been an incredible interview, and there are often tenuous suggestions made by people who research modern conspiracies and things like this. That's not the case in this instance, and so you guys have really done a fine job, and I wanted to give you a moment here at the end also to talk about your book series, The Holy War Chronicles, just as well.
Well, thank you for saying that, and one of the reasons why I sort of spilled the beans so much, and you can see a whole lot more in the documentary because you actually see it real time, on camera, there's nothing held back. Is that I assume people have a lot of skepticism because there's so many of these documentaries that come out and they make so many promises, but all they do is run through the same tired information and then make some idle speculations.
Yeah.
But in this case, we actually have what I consider smoking gun evidence that will actually confirm these things. And so, anyway, I hope this helps the skeptics out there to actually look at this information and maybe feel like we've made some progress right now.
It sounds like it is.
And the moral from it, really, is that you could find people in your own small hometown. You know, we have a tale of two cities. We have the heart of the Bible Belt and the heart of Middle America that both have something that looks innocuous, but underneath there are some ominous overtones, you know, conducted by salt-of-the-earth people, kind of people who would be great next-door neighbors or maybe people in your church. But they have a mindset that can lead to some very ominous conclusions if taken to their completeness. And I think that's a real message that comes out from this. So the Holy War Chronicles, Spiritual View of the War on Terror, it tries to address this problem that we have right now, existential problem with what has been called the War of Civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
And it tries to look at it from the view of a person that spiritually cares about their world and their fellow human beings, and to try to understand what is a sane, practical, and loving understanding to a conflict that we're all being drawn into. And there are many, many surprises in each volume. It's a 6-volume set. It's just being completed right now. I've got one more volume to draft, and then we're going to be sending them out rapid fire out for public consumption, as well as a spinoff book that's been read as well, too, written on it. But it begins right off the bat, providing evidence on how Islamic radical extremism really was started as a project of British intelligence at the start of the 20th century, and how they had actually promoted Islamic extremism as a way to counteract secular independence movement within the Arab colonies, the British colonies in the Arab world. And they had cultivated this pan-Islamism as a way to neutralize the resistance to colonialism. And in fact, had been carried on by the Americans through the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia. And in fact, we even have confessions in print from the top Israeli officials that the same thing had been done with Hamas.
Wow.
So as we start finding out that terror and terrorist groups have been operated by the West for 100 years, both after the war, being blamed on the communists through the Operation Gladio after World War II, people are going to learn from the book about how the Taliban was trained at the University of Nebraska and were taught on how to make roadside bombs by our own Green Berets. How all of the extremist literature and the madrasas were published by the U.S. government. And one revelation after the next follows, and we find out that things aren't what they seem to be.
Which is so often the case in this line of work. Mike, thank you so much for being on the program. We will certainly have you back in the future, and that's going to have to wrap it up because we're coming up on the end of the program. On behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, Tyler Pittman, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Racing Robin Hobbs, Jeremy London, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, we bid you adieu, my friends. And as always, those of you who'd like to reach out, info@graylianreport.com. Love to hear from you, and we will look forward to seeing you next week. In the meantime, as always, I'm Micah Hanks, signing off. Stay strange out there. We'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.